The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy
with Nissan
on News Talk.
We're going to kick things off with our afternoon update, catching you up on all that has happened today. And joining me for it, Liz Dunphy, the senior reporter with the Irish Examiner, and Valerie Cox, the journalist and author. You're both very, very welcome. I know it's kind of a somber start to proceedings, Valerie, but I'm just conscious that lots of people listening would have seen images on their screens in the last couple of hours of Charlie Bird's casket being removed from the Mansion House. He's somebody I'm sure professionally you would have crossed paths with at different times. And personally, I mean, you're both Wicklow residents. Yes. You would have known him.
Yes, Charlie lived in Ashford. And he was very well loved in Wicklow and always willing to turn his hand to anything where people were fundraising or, you know, campaigns they were interested in or whatever. But I think Charlie really, he died such a dignified death. He made the last bit of his life probably the most important. You know, he was a great reporter. I worked in the newsroom alongside him for a long time. But the last section of his life, he just brought everybody with him. People, they fell in love with Charlie and he had this huge influence for good. I was talking to him quite recently and I was just saying that to him, you know, you brought out the best in everybody. And it wasn't just about getting all those thousands of people climbing mountains. It was talking about it and getting them involved in fundraising and thinking about what they could do. And Charlie himself was so generous with his time. Even, you know, when he had quite advanced motor neuron, he was able to turn up with his wife, Claire, the dog, Tiger.
Yeah,
and
Tiger.
You support all of these things that were happening. So I think the turnout today at the Mansion House, I think it was a very fitting tribute to Charlie. And I think, you know, we rarely see a public figure like that living to the very end and spreading this positivity to the very end of their lives and sharing the end of his life. I think that was absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And I think he's somebody who's never going to be forgotten.
No, it's like he's somebody, Liz, and I don't want to go down the road of kind of a really morbid counterfactual, but I mean, without the illness, he would have been held in great respect by everybody and very high esteem because of his work with RTE down through the years. But, you know, Valerie described people as falling in love with him. That didn't happen until the, like that,
no.
That Charlie didn't emerge until the illness.
Not at all.
Because he gave so much of himself, as you alluded to a minute ago, he gave so much of himself during his illness. And that was so brave to expose himself, I suppose, at his most vulnerable moment in a bid to help others, to raise awareness about this terrible disease, which, you know, is an appalling thing for anyone to have to suffer through, and to have the bravery and the generosity of spirit to do that. So, and he raised a huge amount of money. What was it? 3 million for MND and for another charity. I mean, he did phenomenal work towards the end of his life and giving his the last of his energy and the last of his time really on this earth towards helping others. I think that's it's just such a testament to the person that he was. And how could you not fall in love with somebody who is that good a person, really, I suppose.
What impressed me so much about him in recent years as well, Valerie, is that he did everything that we've talked about while still acknowledging how terrified he was of what was coming. You know, some people would kind of approach it very stoically and, you know, well, you know, such is life, you know what I mean? It's kind of inevitable and we just all have to face it. Like he was very open about how awful he found the whole
so
experience,
how
it affected him, how sad he was at night. He talked about kind of, you know, how
he
often he was
about,
in tears.
Crying and
yeah, the fact that he approached it that way, yet still did it so publicly.
Yeah, he really shared everything, didn't he? And, you know, he in those last interviews he did, where he was obviously using the voice box because his own voice was gone, and he was saying things like, I know my death is only around the corner. And he admitted freely, you know, don't like it, would like to be staying around a while longer. And he was very emotional about that, and very emotional. I think he burst into tears one day in Dunstores or somewhere, and he talked about that. And it was just a side effect of the awful disease, and this was happening to him. And then the things he couldn't do. I mean, I was amazed that he climbed Crowpatrick, because that wasn't that long ago.
No.
And it must have been such a huge effort for him to get up there. And he keeps turning up at things. I think he'd even something scheduled for a couple of weeks. in Powersport in Wicklow.
John Kelleher was in here the other day, the day the news broke, who had known Charlie, worked with Charlie 50 years ago, you know, so I'd really known him from the start of his career. And so up until a couple of weeks ago, they were still working on this documentary that's coming out into cinemas in May.
Yeah.
So, you know, like not only out in public, actually working on something unrelated to his condition, you know, just doing kind of old fashioned work. So,
About his fear, actually, if you don't mind, you know, about his fear of death and everything. I did hear a quote on a radio clip recently where he said that he had kind of come to terms with it and that he wasn't scared of death anymore and that he felt that he had had a really good full life and that he was really lucky to have been able to travel the world through his work as a journalist. And yeah, so I think that's something a little bit positive.
And,
to,
you know, maybe it will help other people, help the rest of us to talk about death and talk about our own death, which we're so bad about. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Charlie talked about his own death being cremated. He wants his ashes scattered on the Aran Islands on Inishere. And I think if that's a conversation we can all have, it puts death in a, if you forgive the expression, a more healthy situation to be able to talk about it. I mean, and to plan your own funeral. I mean, my own parents talked openly about death and talked about how they wanted to be cremated. They wanted their ashes scattered where they walked the dogs up in the Wicklow Mountains, you know?
Yeah.
And to be able to do that, it's very, very healthy.
Oh, God, I can't contemplate my own death at all. No, honestly, I'm terrified of it. I would not, if you asked me, I couldn't even begin to plan it. Valerie, could you?
Yeah, I have actually. And I filled out one of those forms where you decide what way you'd like to die and so on and what you want and what you don't want. The Irish Hospice Movement has a booklet with all of these questions that you mightn't think of asking. And they're wonderful that you can actually think about them. Young people are doing it. For example, if you have a dog, what do you want to happen to your dog if you die? Small things like the actual funeral itself. How do you want that to be? Private, big? Do you want to be cremated, buried? What
I want
sort
the
of
dog
treatment?
Buried with me, alive
no,
or dead.
That's cruel to the dog. The ISPCA.
He deserves it. I tell you, he deserves this bloody dog. Anyway, listen. There'll be so many eulogies to Charlie, and also well deserved as well. And I think, look, we'll repeat what we said the other day. I think everybody's thoughts with Claire and with the kids and with everybody else, first and foremost. You know, he kind of became a public figure. We all felt maybe a sense of ownership, but they'd have felt the loss most acutely.
He couldn't have done it without Claire by his side,
just
supporting
by
him.
By his side, incredible.
She's an amazing woman.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, a topic we are coming back to on the show, I do want to ask your views about, right? We're talking about it after 5 o'clock, and it's about abuse of politicians. I guess it's nothing new, politicians kind of getting it in the neck. There was a sense, though, Liz, that it kind of ramped up in the last 12 months. We had Michael Healy-Rae being pushed around outside the Dáil, and there was those protests with kind of a noose in politicians' heads. And then we have this thing now, and we would have seen it, people might have seen it in the wake of the referendum results as well, of kind of people turning up, the usual agitators online, showing and screaming abuse into politicians' faces. And they're kind of, they don't really care about the response. What they're doing is they're creating online content.
Yeah, there definitely has been a movement in that direction, particularly with the whole, you know, anti-immigrant, I suppose, anti-migrant kind of protests. Like even today, we saw clips of the Sinn Féin TD, Angus O'Snodig, being abused, called terrible things like a rat by somebody who was very angry in a video clip posted online. Also, actually in the Indo today, we saw a report by Shane Phelan about a far-right agitator called Derek Blythe, who's now being sued by a businessman in Cork, in the High Court, because of, you know, going to his home, the place where he's living, and also to a business which he had a stake in. It's called Abbeyville House. It's a former B&B in Fermoy, and it's been the site of a lot of protests, anti-immigrant protests, because there were plans for the Department of Integration to move in some 56 refugees or asylum seekers. That actually, since the protests, the government kind of backtracked a little bit and said that they wouldn't move in male asylum seekers and would move in instead families, because some of the local protesters were saying they didn't want men. Poor men get an awful doing these days, unfortunately. But so it's part of this whole movement. And interestingly, actually, the Association of Local Government just this week released findings of a survey which found that the majority of local councillors are getting a huge amount of abuse, death threats, you know, threats of violence, threats of arson, terrible things. And over 63% of respondents reported experiencing threats between April 2021 and September 2023. And I think that really reflects the kind of the environment that we're living in at the moment. Like Mary Butler, you know, the Waterford Fianna Fáil TD and the Minister of State for Mental Health and Disabilities, she has received a huge amount of abuse recently. You know, the Gardaí at one stage told her that she should stay in her home because the threats were so credible. She's spoken about not feeling that she can walk down Grafton Street on her lunch break anymore when she's in Leinster House, and going straight from Leinster House to the hotel where she's staying to avoid threats. Also, Holly Cairns, the Social Democrat leader, she had to close down her constituency office in Cork in January and it's no longer open because of the amount of threats she was getting. She had a stalker coming to her house. She had to install CCTV. She had to totally change the security in her home because of the amount of abuse she was getting. And like, that just speaks to the... Actually, interestingly, I was speaking to a senior guard recently, and he was saying that there's been this change in the levels of aggression that Gardaí are seeing on the streets,
yeah.
The levels of impatience, and there does seem to be this kind of swelling of, yeah, just aggression and entitlement and impatience.
And Valerie, when you mention kind of Joe Cox in this context, the MP in the UK who was stabbed to death, people kind of immediately accuse you of hyperbole. But then nobody saw the Dublin riots coming.
No,
you know,
you just
really fear where this might go.
Yeah, absolutely frightening and appalling. I mean, we've had it in Wicklow, where we have a lot of TDs in Wicklow. Well, no more than anywhere else, I suppose. But we've had a lot of aggression towards them. And I remember people turning up in the gardens of Simon Harris's house. And he had small children. You know, I mean, that is absolutely appalling. And as you say, like in the Joe Cox case, you just don't know where it's going to end. I mean, you just push it a little bit further. And you remember even when Angus Osnathy was involved in that attack on the Dáil, where they pushed in through the gates and went in, and people were frightened. I mean, some of the protesters, the Gardaí took control, and after that evening then there was a complete line of Gardaí around outside Leinster House. But they went up to the Garda box inside Leinster House, and the guy inside was threatened, and people had to pull batons. The Gardaí had to use their batons. I mean, that sort of behaviour is absolutely appalling. Then we had the attack on Helen McEntee's car. I mean, that was the bomb threats against Helen McEntee, and loads of protests, you know, where people are turning up inside people's gardens. I mean, it's an absolutely appalling thing to happen. And interestingly enough, in this particular case that you mentioned there, the Derek Bligh case, that man was an immigrant himself.
Mm-hmm. You know, Canada.
He was in Canada.
In Canada, yeah.
And, you know, he's organising this. And you see, it's very easy. I mean, you know, everybody has this saying that if for evil to happen, we only need the good people to stay quiet. And it's so true. Because when something like the riots happen, people just get involved. They say, oh, I'll have a bit of this. I'll get involved. I'll vent my frustration. And the original reason the riot started might be nothing whatsoever to do with them. But it brings out this violence, this mob control, this herd thing. And it's just appalling.
Yeah. And I know when you say kind of Derek Bligh, the one doing this, we're talking about the protests in Fermoy and stuff,
yes,
rather than kind of bomb threats and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Just to clarify that. But it's like there is a real sense of this all ramping up. And on Valerie's point is as well about kind of the role of the Gardaí. I mean, you can understand why they've had a more standoffish. Partly it's just kind of a culture within the Gardaí of not kind of being confrontational. You know what I mean? That's just kind of one of the kind of principles of the force, the kind of keepers of the peace rather than enforcers of the law.
Yep.
At the same time, you wonder whether we're getting to a point where there has to be a change in tactic.
And I think there has. I think since the Dublin riots, there has been a change in tactic, in fairness. And there were 13 people, I think, but I could stand to correction on that, arrested in relation to the riots outside the effigies and the gallows being posted outside the Dáil in September, the protest there that you were talking about a second ago. But I think at the beginning, there definitely did seem to be very much a standoffish element to the Gardaí's policing of these kind of protests. And I think they felt that they didn't want to make martyrs of some of these people. You know, some of these people would go around, I've seen them at these rallies or protests, and pointing cameras in everyone's faces. And, you know, they want to be made martyrs of, almost,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And they want the Gardaí to come down in a way so that they can say, oh, look at, you yeah. know, what the state is doing to me. But I think Gardaí are becoming more harder on it now,
yeah.
And there are more arrests.
And, you know, this is seeping through to schools as well. I was talking to a teacher yesterday who was telling me that a kid from his own school and another school had a public fight on the street. But all the other kids videoed it and put it up on social media so they could immediately identify the kids responsible anyway. But I think another big part of the problem is that people are becoming much more inclined to attack guards and, you know, to come after them and beat them up. If I just tell you a small story, my father-in-law, my late father-in-law, was a guard, the sergeant in Howth. And apparently when my husband was growing up, he remembers his dad who got on his bicycle, chased after people and said, stop. And they stopped. That wouldn't happen.
What a different culture now. Yeah. And Drew Harris's face was the Garda Commissioner. His face was one of the faces on that effigy, actually, outside the Doyle back in September. Yeah. So it's at Leinster House.
On a completely different note, then, can I ask who you'd include in an Irish Walk of Fame? So we're going to speak to this Meath County Councillor a little bit later, who, surprise, surprise, thinks we should have a Hollywood-style Walk of Fame and it should be in County Meath. I'm sure he has reasons beyond the fact he's a Meath councillor. We'll have to wait and see. Who would you put in it, Liz?
I think there are just so many people that we could put in it.
Stop. Okay. You're a politician. You're beside me.
I have a lot of respect for Noeline Blackwell, who recently retired from a CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. I think she's done a huge amount of work to improve through her work with FLAC, the Free Legal Aid organisation, but also through the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, her work to kind of change the culture around sexual violence and gender-based violence in Ireland. In a similar vein, Mary Crilly, who helped establish a Cork version, basically, of the Rape Crisis Centre, the Cork Sexual Violence Centre. She has done enormous work in Cork, helping more than 10,000 people who suffered rape and sexual abuse at a time when it was very, very unpopular to be championing these kind of causes. Like, it was a time in the 80s when, you know, you couldn't get contraception without a prescription. Marital rape was legal. Homosexuality was illegal. It was just a really such a different time. And, you know, these women were so brave in kind of championing these causes and really pushing for positive change in Ireland. I think Mary Robinson has done phenomenal work both in Ireland and abroad in pushing for peace and pushing to make the world a kind of better place.
Did you not put any poor oppressed men on it there?
Yeah, no, plenty. Loads of wonderful men on it as well.
Valerie, who would you include?
Well, I wouldn't include any of them, to be honest. I think Meath County Council have a neck. They really do. Because you know what? You mentioned Pierce Brosnan. Pierce Brosnan, you know, son of Navin. Do you know what they did last week? The diggers moved in and they demolished Pierce Brosnan's old childhood home on Convent Road on the banks of the River Boyne. The diggers went in and he spent all his childhood years there with his grandparents. And as somebody, I'm quoting them, imagine the people of Cork allowing Cillian Murphy's birthplace and upbringing to be demolished like this. So, I mean, they want a Hollywood Walk of Fame or a Meath Walk of Fame and they go out and they demolish the Brosnan homestead. I mean, would you listen to any of them?
Putting a man on the list, can I please put Cillian Murphy? I'll be lynched when I go back to Cork if I don't. He's a very popular man down there.
He certainly is. Liz Duffy, senior reporter with the Irish Examiner. Valerie Cox, journalist and author. Listen, thanks a million, both of you, for joining me in studio.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With Nissan.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.